Well, good morning and welcome to The Library Show. My name is Brooke and I am delighted to be here and this morning for the next half an hour talking to my guest about books. And today I'm excited to announce that it's my mom in the studio with me. Elizabeth Schaefer is her name. And as long as I have known her, which is about 36 years, she's been a voracious reader. So she's the perfect guest for this particular show where we talk about books and what we've been reading and, frankly, what's in our book bag. So, Elizabeth, what is in your book bag today?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. I'm a proud mom, happy to be in the studio with my daughter. One of the books in my book bag is something that my other daughter, Summer, has written. It's just been published in the 3288 Review, a journal of arts and letters for West Michigan and beyond. This story, short story, is a chapter in her novel, which she currently has an agent trying to get the novel published. This novel is about a fictitious city in Alaska, and it's called Hope. I thought I would read the opening portion of this chapter of the book, and it's called A Final Affair. In the middle of downtown Hope, described in the tour books as a quaint and historical island paradise in southeast Alaska, is a patch of fenced-in muskeg from which three lichen-covered logs posts protrude. The remnants of a pioneer's cabin that started sinking into the muskeg the months following the 1954 earthquake and that officially succumbed to the ground around the same time that the runway was built in 1967. Wild blueberries and salmonberries grow there, as do dwarf trees covered in lichen, wild roses, and a very hardy Swiss chard that went rogue after an avid public lands gardener planted 20 seeds of in 1970. Long-timers and local historians believe that the cabin belonged to an unnamed man who came up around 1901, probably to look for gold. Accounts from that time mention a white man, hairy as a bear, who frequented the brothel, often sang uproariously in the road without shame after visiting the bar, and once he discovered that there was no gold on the island, put all his efforts into building a log cabin, about which he appears to know nothing. No one knows what happened to him, though some accounts say he went crazy and disappeared into the mountains. In 1969, the Hope General Assembly agreed to officially designate the spot a place of historical significance and erected the fence and a placard with an artist's rendition of what the cabin might have looked like and the words, "Here lies a vestige of Hope's early pioneering days. This pioneer cabin dates from around 1901 and was most likely built by someone who came to Hope to try his luck at finding gold. There is, however, no gold in Hope." Most venturers eventually found their way into Hope's lucrative fur industry. Now, the place stands testament to the fact that the roads around are themselves slowly sinking into the soft ground, as are the sidewalks and stores whose fronts were made to look how Hope might have looked in 1910, if indeed had been a gold rush town. And even though the cabin might as well not even be there, there are, after all, those three lichen-laden posts, as if remnants of long-gone trees, which lend a certain historical and mystery-tinged aura to the place. Long-timer Maggie Whitehall sometimes likes to imagine what Hope would have been like then, the one dirt road imperfectly hacked by the Russian missionaries into the muskeg and ash from the eruption of Mount Agnes 5,000 years ago, sitting dormant 1 mile from Hope's shores. The cabin hacked together from felled spruce trees and set down in the mud. The hairy, crazy white man working away at it and probably looking pretty sexy while doing it. He'd be fit and muscular. He'd exude smells of sweat and alcohol and tobacco and fire smoke. It would be dark and smoky in the cabin. It wouldn't keep the ocean wind or the cold out at all, and beyond it would be a great wild humming quietness full of grizzlies, deer, bald eagles, and ghosts. Maggie was one of the first to come up as a nurse in 1945 when several hundred troops were stationed in Hope to defend the country from a possible Japanese infiltration from the Pacific. She still has fond memories of making out with Jim Johnson in one of the bunkers by the runway. He was the first one she let touch her, an accomplishment that soon became all too common with other men. She discovered how lucrative and satisfying it was to work evenings and nights in the gentleman's trade, which filled a chiasmic niche in hope for all those men up for the war or fishing or hunting or business starting. They were a varied bunch, those men. Some hated the rain and boredom of island life. They couldn't wait to get back to Oklahoma or California or Pennsylvania. Others had left behind acts of crime or unfortunate family names that would destine them to a life of averageness or struggle. In hope, they could start all over again, pretend they were somebodies who would in fact go on to open restaurants and Hope's First stores and become rich. Maggie called the shots. She learned that she was good at it, and the men respected her apparent expertise, not for once taking into consideration that she simply had one of those fantastic imaginations and was, in fact, living the clandestine life she had always imagined for herself. I will stop there. From there, four characters from Hope are introduced, and the interaction between each other goes on, and hopefully sometime the novel will be produced, and we will get to enjoy the life of this mystic city called Hope, Alaska.
So it's clearly, you know, based on Sitka, it sounds like, with the volcano about a mile away, and I know because this is my sister, but that she used to live in Sitka, so she kind of has taken some of her experiences from the time that she's lived here off and on.
Yes,
to that's kind of inspired this particular novel. It sounds like
In fact, the characters, I think many of us long-timers here might even say, well, that kind of seems like so and so. She's cobbled together, you know, different personalities and made fictitious characters. But yes, they'd be characters I think that we could certainly recognize as being very typical to Sitka.
Okay, yeah. Well, that could be intriguing.
Yes.
What else do you have there in your book bag?
Well, I read three great books this summer. One is called The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. And certainly was something that I never had heard of before or knew anything about. The city is called Oak Ridge, and it was built in Tennessee during the middle of World War II, and housed 75,000 people, and pretty much was a secret city that nobody in the world knew existed, except for the few people in that region. Even though some did know the city existed, they didn't know what for, and they didn't really know what they were doing there, including the people who lived in the city. The city was completely walled in. You had to pass through security to get in and out. You took an oath to never tell anybody what you were doing, including your family members. It was a time of really good work opportunity for men and women. What's really interesting is that it drew many, many women from around the country to work there. They didn't know what They only did one part. Each person only did one part in this process. They didn't know what their part was or how it fit into what the whole was. So, and you could lose your job if you spoke about it to any other coworker in the city there.
So I'm not sure I totally understand. People were applying for jobs. They heard that there was work needed and they would apply to this job in the city, but they didn't actually know what the work was that
That's
they were
going
to be doing. And then once they got the job, they had to move into the city too and not
leave it?
They had
to move in, yes. Uh-huh. And they were told that the job that they were doing would end the world war. And that's why they were so willing. There were good wages, but that's another reason they were so willing. Many of the women had husbands, sweethearts, brothers, fathers who were in the war, who had been killed in the war, and they thought, well, this is my way then to help this war effort. So including the scientists involved, nobody really knew what the other hand was doing, but it all fit together, and it was all about the atomic bomb. And the book, the fly says, you know, that says that we didn't really know what was going on. We'd heard about the Manhattan Project. We know about, you know, the atomic bomb and how it was being built. But what's in this book is truly really interesting and all new information to me. It was taken from interviews with women who are now in their 80s and 90s, still alive, and were working in Atomic City. So there are pictures in there, direct quotes from these women. Very, very interesting read.
And they were ultimately building the atomic bomb?
They were all apart in this quest to build the atomic bomb, yes.
Okay.
So there were women who worked in Switzerland and, say, in Germany who were scientists. But because they were women and had come up with some of the key things that were important in the production of the atomic bomb, because they were women, were not listened to, they were actually able to come to the United States and work in this effort and have the information that they knew be put together with other scientists in our country who were working on this. In fact, many scientists from other countries also came eventually and worked and lived in this city to accomplish the putting together of the atomic bomb.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. I actually think now that you're talking about it, I think there's someone in Sitka whose mother may have worked there. I only know from my job at the library, checked it out. She checked the book out and was excited about it because I think it was her mom who had worked there. And so she was excited to read about this secret other life.
Yes,
she
I'd
had.
Love to talk to her and see what her mom ever told her about it.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the book is pretty, gives you a pretty good peek into that world, though.
It does.
More than a peek.
Yes, yes. It was very interesting. And then another book just happened to be another World War II book. It's called All the Light We Cannot See.
Oh, this is so popular right now. Yeah.
I couldn't put the book down. It's been quite a few months since I finished reading it. I still find myself thinking about it and really wanting to go back and reread it just because it made such an impact on me. I think the way books begin are fascinating. So if we have time, I thought I would read three really quick paragraphs on how this book begins.
Great.
So it begins one page. It says leaflets. At dusk, they pour from the sky. They blow across the ramparts, turn cartwheels over rooftops, flutter into the ravines between houses. Entire streets swirl with them, flashing white against the cobbles. Urgent message to the inhabitants of this town, they say. Depart immediately to open country. The tide climbs. The moon hangs small and yellow and gibbous. On the rooftops of beachfront hotels to the east and in the gardens behind them, a half a dozen American artillery units drop incendiary rounds into the mouths of mortars. The next page is called Bombers. They cross the channel at midnight. There are 12, and they are named for songs, stardust and stormy weather, and in the mood and pistol-packing mama. The sea glides along far below, spattered with the countless chevrons of white caps. Soon enough, the navigators can discern the low, moonlit lumps of islands ranged along the horizon. France. Intercoms crackle. Deliberately, almost lazily, the bombers shed altitude. Threads of red light ascend from anti-air emplacements up and down the coast. Dark, ruined ships appear, scuttled or destroyed, one with its bow shorn away, a second flickering as it burns. On an outermost island, panicked sheep run zigzagging between rocks. Inside each airplane, a bombardier peers through an aiming window and counts to 20. 4, 5, 6, 7. To the bombardiers, the walled city on its granite headland, drawing ever closer, looks an unholy tooth, something black and dangerous, a final abscess to be lanced away. The next page is called The Girl. In a corner of the city, inside a tall, narrow house at number 4 Rue Vauboral, on the 6th and highest floor, a sightless 16-year-old named Marie-Laurie LeBlanc kneels over a low table covered entirely with a model. The model is a miniature of the city she kneels within and contains scale replicas of the hundreds of houses and shops and hotels within its walls. There's the cathedral with its perforated spire and the bulky old Chateau de Saint-Malo, and row after row of seaside mansions studded with chimneys. A slender wooden jetty arcs out from a beach called the Plage du Mole. A delicate, reticulated atrium vaults over the seafood market. Minute benches, the smallest no larger than apple seeds, dot the tiny public squares. Marie Laurie runs her fingertips along the centimeter-wide parapet, crowning the ramparts, drawing an uneven star shape around the entire model. She finds the opening atop the walls where four ceremonial cannons point to the sea. Bastion de la Hollande, she whispers, and her fingers walk down a little staircase, Rue de Cordiers, Rue Jacques Cartier. In a corner of the room stand two galvanized buckets filled to the rim with water. Fill them up, her great uncle has taught her, whenever you can. The bathtub on the third floor, too. Who knows when the water will go out again? Her fingers travel back to the cathedral spire, south to the gate of Dinan. All evening she has been marching her fingers around the model, waiting for her great uncle Etienne, who owns this house, who went out the previous night while she slept, and who has not returned. And now it is night again. Another revolution of the clock, and the whole block is quiet, and she cannot sleep. She can hear the bombers when they are 3 miles away, a mounting static, the hum inside a seashell. When she opens the bedroom window, the noise of the airplanes become louder. Otherwise, the night is dreadfully silent. No engines, no voices, no clatter, no sirens, no footfalls on the cobbles, not even gulls. Just a high tide, one block away, and six stories below, lapping at the base of the city walls. And something else, something rattling softly, very close. She eases open the left-hand shutter and runs her fingers up the slats of the right. A sheet of paper has lodged there. She holds it to her nose. It smells of fresh ink, gasoline maybe. The paper is crisp. It has not been outside long. Marie Laurie hesitates at the window in her stocking feet, her bedroom behind her, seashells arranged along the top of the armoire, pebbles along the baseboards. Her cane stands in the corner. Her big braille novel fades down on the bed. The drone of the airplanes grows. So what's interesting about this book is it simultaneously shows this young 16-year-old girl in France, the story of her existence there in Saint-Malo, and Paul's going to laugh at my French when he hears this.
No, that's great.
And then simultaneously there's an orphan German boy in Germany who turns out to be very gifted in science and electronics, and one that is found out accidentally. He is taken in the Hitler regime and put into an academy where he is forced to design radios and work in radios. And eventually the work that he does working in the German army and sends him towards Saint-Malo. And he and the life of this girl intersect briefly, and it makes a lifelong impact on both of them. One survives, one does not. One we get to see as a very elderly person, and eventually this elderly person meets family of the other one who doesn't survive, and there's some closure and a really interesting story.
Wow, it sounds, yeah. And I was taken right in by the way that the author is writing, just a really nice way with language.
Yes.
Kind of draws you right in.
Yes, very much so. I liked, and this is written by Anthony Doerr, D-O-E-R-R.
And it looks like I noticed on the front of it that it was a finalist for the National
Book Award.
Yes. Is that for this year then, 2015? Maybe we're yet to find out.
2014,
if he'll... maybe. Oh, okay. I don't know.
I'm not sure, actually. Yeah. I'm not sure. So.
Well, yeah, it sounds like it might be a bit of a sad story, but very well written. And
very well written. Yeah. And it gave me more insight of what it was like to be in French-occupied... French occupation of France during World War II, and how the various people responded to that occupation. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting. Makes me wonder how we Americans would respond if we were ever occupied. Who of us would be brave and could put up some resistance and survive?
And it seems like just from the little piece you read that maybe that's an insight into the title too, All the Light We Cannot See. She seems to be blind.
She is blind. Yeah. She got sick and was blinded when she was 6 years old.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. That's kind of interesting too.
And it is, because you see the way that she sees, and through sight and through touch and
smelling
smells.
The paper. Right.
Interesting how she could see things that some of us visually couldn't even see right away, which you see through other people and their responses.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Oh, it sounds like a great book. Yeah.
I recommend it.
Yeah. Do you have anything else in your book bag this morning?
I do have one more book. It's light. I just took a trip to Vermont, had lengthy airplane flights, and I tend to do light reading. Found a mystery by James Rollins, and it's called The Sixth Extinction. And what was really interesting about it, it's very scientific. It's about very appropriate for the time period that we're in right now, dealing with global warming. All the experimentation that we're doing now into DNA, being able to replicate cells and to make even now life. We've now been able to make, create life supposedly. So it deals with all of this and how it's the sixth extinction of life as we know it on this earth. And what I really enjoyed about it, I mean, I couldn't put it down. I read it before my flight was, I'd finished it before my flight was over, because you can't wait to see what's going to happen and how this does end, is a lot of it was based on fact. And I like novels that are based on fact because you can learn something at the same time while, you know, using creativity and imagination. So at the end of this book, there's a whole chapter where the author just explains the science of everything that he put in this book so that you know what's fact and what's just made up. And most of it's based on fact, which I found really interesting. Oh. And find myself thinking a lot about, because I think it's appropriate to the times that we live in now and to the possible changes that might happen.
Is he a scientist or he just did research? It's not an author's name that I recognize. I don't know if he's, is he new to you?
He's new to me, and I don't know if he has a science background. Let me see if it says anywhere in anything about him.
I know a lot of writers do a lot of research, but, you know, for their novels, so that could be the case with him too.
Yes. I really don't know. It doesn't say this, just that his books have been translated into more than 40 languages. So he's popular, and I will probably read more of his as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that kind of, weren't you just talking about, I don't know that you brought it with you today, but I think you mentioned that you read The Martian also on this trip to Vermont.
I did.
Which is, I haven't read it myself, so I don't know, but I know that it's, or I've heard that it's a lot based on, there's a lot of science in it.
There is. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, it'll be too much. You know, I'll get bored. My eyes will glaze over. I'll skip pages and pages to get to the interesting part. But I saw the movie and I just...
Before
I read the book. Usually I will read the book first and then see the movie. But I saw the movie, really enjoyed it. And that made me decide I wanted to read the book. And I am not a science person. I don't understand it easily. My brain doesn't work that way. But I read every word of that book, including all of the science, and I found it very easy to understand. Mm. And it made what happened really plausible up there. Thoroughly enjoyed that book as well and would recommend reading it. Even if you've seen the movie, it's worth reading the book.
Okay, yeah. So two science books.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know, I can't believe it.
That's great, though. Yes. Yeah. Well, I actually happen to bring a couple things along with me as well. So maybe I'll just mention a couple of things I've been reading. I've been reading actually for quite some time now, The Paris Review, which is a journal you can get. I don't know how many times a year it comes out, but this is the spring 2015 issue. And it's just a literary journal, kind of combines. This one has interviews with writers. It always has poetry and kind of experimental fiction or experimental writing. And the piece that I just finished is from the Paris Review, and it's a short story. So it's just straight up fiction. It's by James Lasden, someone I hadn't heard of. And the piece is called Feathered Glory. And wasn't really planning to read from it, but I thought I would at least mention it because it's kind of in some ways a typical story in that it's about relationships. So it's about a couple of married couples and, you know, at first sort of about one married couple that seems to have their act together as far as keeping together, staying together and being content with each other, and another married couple that seems a little bit like they're struggling to stay together and not sure if it's the right relationship. But by the end of the short story, both relationships have kind of become a little bit, it's unclear as to if they are both really these solid relationships that the one had appeared to be. And I think what I particularly enjoyed about it was that despite the fact that it's kind of a traditional topic, it was handled in a slightly different way where a big part of it is the one of the wives taking in a swan to care for it and then release it back into the wild. Just kind of by happenstance, a friend she knows takes care of animals, and so she happens to help this particular bird. And it ends up the focus shifts from these relationships to kind of this wife, her relationship with a swan, and you end up seeing some parallels, I guess, between the relationships between the animal and the human, and then the humans and the ways that they are similar and dissimilar. And I think there's some metaphor at work there for what's going on with the relationship. So it's a kind of a poignant piece and entertaining, and I think worth reading. So that one's from the Paris Review, which you can probably get here in town at Harry Race, or they do such a good job of carrying periodicals of different sorts. So I would recommend that
Harry
one.
Harry Race does?
Yeah, they do.
I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh. And I think even if they don't carry the Paris Review, you could probably talk to someone there about getting it ordered, or maybe special ordering an issue. Huh. Yeah, they do a great job. So if you're looking for periodicals before you go on a plane trip, that's one place to check out. And then I'll briefly mention one other book that I just finished reading, and it's called The Principles of Uncertainty, and it's by Myra Kallman, and I got it through our library here. It actually lives in Anchorage, but it's part of our catalog, and we can easily order it. So I checked it out because a friend had it and recommended it when she returned it, and so I just kind of snuck it away from her. And it is a book that is kind of part art book. So it's filled with pictures that she paints, and then part her musings. And it's, she describes it as, how does she describe it? I think it's something like a, well, let's see. I thought it said somewhere succinctly what it was about, but it's a highly detailed look at a year of her life. And then she adds art to the whole thing. And I really enjoyed it and recommend looking for it. I just wanted to read one small passage from it. It opens up kind of a new chapter, and she opens each chapter with the date. So this is October 4th, 2006. And it's, she says, summer-like, sunny. And then she opens it up with writing this time. It says, how do you know who you are? Half the time, I don't know who I am. Maybe even 7/8. Never mind. Forget it. Forget it. But how can I forget it? Does it have something to do with language? Everything I say, I regret saying. What if I did not speak? If you came to my house and we sat at the kitchen table and had a cup of coffee with cream that I had just poured from this pitcher, and then you turn the page and there's a drawing of this picture. She continues, what would happen? We could stare out the window and watch a ship from the Wisdom Line pass by. But let's say you were hoping for a piece of cake with your coffee. You could ask me for that. Then I would say that talking is good for conveying information. For instance, I say hello to my neighbor. How are you? And she says, my husband is crazy. Well, there you go. If we did sit in silence, you might notice that there are many objects displayed around the apartment. Collections, tangible evidence of history, memory, longing, delight. There is my empty box collection. And then from there, she goes on to several pages that are illustrations, paintings of boxes that are apparently around her house, empty boxes. So what I like about this book is it's like this marriage of kind of whimsical with also philosophy, thinking about the world and how we exist in it and how what we might take pleasure in kind of a sometimes mystifying world. But I think I have said plenty, especially because we're running out of time. And I think it's time for me to say thank you for tuning into the Library Show. Thank you very much, Elizabeth Schaefer, for joining me here in the studio. It was great to hear what books you've been reading. And those of you listening out there, you can check in with us. Maybe on Facebook would be the easiest way to get a list of the books that we've talked about today and find them for yourselves.
And I just wanted to put in that Atomic Girls of the Girls of Atomic City and All the Light We Cannot See, I bought at Old Harbor Books.
Okay, great. So you can get them at Old Harbor, yes. Perhaps, if yes. You want to buy them. Come yes. By the library. We'll see about ordering them for you. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.